Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man who has returned to where he was spawned, almost, not really, because I was born in Yorkshire. It's Richard Herring. I'm in Somerset. Hello. Welcome to Richard Herring's lo-fi Somerset transmission podcast. I've come back to Cheddar to see my folks, forgetting that I'd already arranged to do a podcast today. So we are doing this double remotely. Chris Evans is in Wales. I'm in Cheddar in Somerset. My guest, who knows, could be in the Caribbean. I've no idea where he is. And so it's great to be back in Cheddar doing this from my childhood home. Though I was talking to Jeff Quigley down at Maunders on Barrows Road. I generally was. I went for a run around the reservoir, bumped into the man who I went interrailing with in 1987. He looks a lot older now, but I think I look the same. And it feels like only yesterday. We hitchhiked around Europe together, and that was insane. We were babies. We were so naive. Anyway, he calls it Rahel Estepa. So his daughter apparently listens to the podcast, so hello. And she can't believe it when I mention Jeff Quigley and my stuff. So there we go. So I am back in Cheddar, and it's very nice to be here. It's kind of apt for this week's guest because this is where it was in this house that I first became aware of this week's guest. So that's quite exciting. And first saw him and where I became obsessed with the work and the show he was in. That's quite apt. But it's good to be back seeing my parents. I haven't seen them for 18 months, so that's kind of weird. There hasn't been an 18-month period in my life where I've not seen my parents in the flesh. And also, as I'm writing a new series of Relativity for this autumn, it's pretty good to get back to see them because I need material. And I got material because they'd been watching that programme, The Naked Attraction, and they were all going on about how terrible Naked Attraction was. They couldn't believe it. And then Dad said, it's on tonight, apparently, and as he circled it in the Radio Times. And they were sort of pretending they didn't know what it was. They're going, what has the world come to? And they started telling me about the games they played as teenagers, the dating games they played as teenagers in the late 1940s, one of which was called Buzz Off, in which there'd be four couples and one spare person. And then they would kiss in the community centre. I don't know how much they would kiss in their couples, and then the spare one would come up and tell one of the guys to buzz off and take over. I mean, this is swinging. This is worse than Naked Attraction. And then my mum also said they played a game called Winky, which I thought now it's getting pretty hot. But that was about winking at each other. A similar thing. There was one spare guy. I don't know if everyone had to bring a spare guy or just there was one guy who didn't have a girlfriend. And then they winked at each other. It was very sweet and casual. But apparently my dad first managed to kiss my mum by saying they've been going out for a few weeks and they were walking together. And he said, shall we play Buzz Off? But they were alone. So, you know, that just meant, shall we go and have a snog? I've learned things I did not need to know about my parents. My mum told me a big story about her grandma in Christchurch Priory wanting to go up the tower. She wasn't allowed to go up the tower, but then she snuck in and went up the tower and got to the top of the tower and then looked around. It was amazing. Went down and the door was locked. Then she went back up the tower and she prayed. And when she went down the tower, the door was open again. And she said that Jesus had opened the door for her. What I want to know is, how did she know Jesus didn't lock the door in the first place? And B, you know, what's Jesus doing hanging around churches locking and unlocking women up? There's also a miracle at Christchurch Priory where a beam was cut too short when they were building it. And then when they went away overnight, they came back and the beam had magically was the right length and had been installed. And again, that was Jesus. But Jesus spends a lot of time just hanging around in churches doing pranks and stuff, it seems. So maybe it was Jesus. Maybe it wasn't. But I'm getting a lot of material for my show, I have to say. Anyway, let's crack on. My guest this week is probably best known for playing Lawrence Didcot in the show Bonjour la Classe alongside previous guests. And now my mind's gone back. Rebecca Callard, thank you. I've just remembered Rebecca Callard was also in Bonjour la Classe, and that's how I introduced her. Will you please welcome the incredible, absolute hero of mine? It's Nigel Planer, ladies and gentlemen. Here he is. Hello, Nigel.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Bonjour.
Bonjour la Classe. What are your memories of Bonjour la Classe?
Oh, I love doing Bonjour la Classe. I kind of... I worked with the writers Smith and Kayam, quite a lot to make that character. They just came to me actually with a page, which doesn't often happen.
Yeah,
with a page of the thoughts of this French teacher, and I just identified because I'd had a French teacher like that. I just love that, the over enthusiastic teacher who says, you know, now I want you all to be very kind to Botany today because his parents are separating, so nobody bully Botany today, okay, and thinks he's done Botany a favour.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you recall it fondly. I watched everything that all of you guys did in those early days. I was obsessed with comedy, so I do remember it, and do you remember Rebecca Callard being in it, being one of the, she's gone on to be a pretty successful actor. I think she was playing one of the students, Rebecca Callard.
I keep bumping into quite a few of them. Brian Dick is another one,
right.
Very, very brilliant guy who played Ernie Wise in that play about Eric and Ernie.
Right, oh great, yes.
With Victoria Wood's play, and I've worked with him a couple of times since.
Right.
All those kids who were just like the school kids.
Yeah.
You know, you meet them quite shortly afterwards because, of course, people grow up so fast.
Yeah.
And, Rebecca. And it was good. There was a lovely scene at the end where the school orchestra is gathered, and they had the actual school orchestra.
Yeah.
And Lawrence is singing too enthusiastically along the back row. You know, the teachers who would always sing in the very, very, very high voice and really put their full energy in. And he sort of trips and stumbles, and it's a lovely shot. We could only do one take. He stumbles and falls forward on the whole row of bassoons, or, you know, the brass section,
yes,
who fall forward. And he literally falls down three, four rows, and the entire orchestra are flattened because it's like dominoes. And that was good. I'm not good on stunts, but that was such fun to do that.
Yes. Well, there are a few stunts I recall, but yes. So let's talk about our relationship with each other, which is not... I mean, I was a huge fan of all the the 80s comedy, and that was, for me, all of, especially the young ones, was sort of my punk rock, and that was the epiphany for me. I'd love Python and all that stuff, and I've been into that, but the young ones were sort of our generation's thing that made it look like comedy might be a possible thing to make a career of. But we very early on, Stuart and I met you once we'd started working professionally. And
I remember.
Do you remember what that? I'm struggling to remember what the project was.
I've been thinking about it since I knew I was coming on here. I think it was for a project that ended up being called Wake Up With.
Right.
That was about Jonathan and Libby Hughes, which was myself and Susie Blake.
Right.
And we were, it sounds very prescient, this. It was like a Richard and Judy couple.
Right.
Who are having a divorce, and her ex-husband is the producer, played by Stephen Moore. And they've got to carry on with their show because they are the daytime TV. They do a show called Wake Up With. It's based on a book that I wrote with Terence Blacker, or Terence Blacker wrote with me, called Let's Get Divorced. with two smiling people, you know, I had the hair and the looking very, very sort of healthy and sporty. And they want to get a divorce, and that'll ruin the show. They can't get divorced.
Yeah.
So they invent this thing called positive divorcehood. And they decide to produce a book and go out in public going, you know, hey, it's okay being separate and yet together, you know.
Yes.
And this was a long time ago, and nowadays that doesn't seem so surprising, does it?
No, but, often.
Anyway, we only got to make the pilot of this thing for ITV, I think. And unfortunately, it didn't go to series. And maybe because you didn't write the script.
We didn't write it. I'm not sure. I think my memory is that, and I remember very little about it, but I remember it about being something about a panel show, and this might have been someone else as well, that was that you were going to be a judge or something. It was like a Judge Judy sort of thing, I think. It was that is what I remember. Ah. So
it was with a producer called Jamie Ricks, wasn't it? Do you remember Jamie Ricks?
Yeah, it definitely was Jamie Ricks. That's what I remembered. Yeah.
And it was an office in the Riverside Studios.
Yeah, that's right.
And you guys were sort of fresh out of university.
Yeah.
And I don't think you'd even done your sketch TV show.
No, we hadn't. It would have been, we probably had done On the Hour and maybe done a bit of stuff.
On the Hour, yeah.
But so we were writers. Well,
maybe not even On the Hour. I don't think had done On the Hour, because that was...
It was very early. We did like...
On the Hour was the radio version, wasn't it?
Yeah, of the day to day, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, you'd probably just done it On the Hour. Yeah. Anyway, Jamie Ricks was producer, and the reason I thought it was that Let's Get Divorced type thing was because he was the producer on that.
Right, it might be that.
I don't remember a judge thing.
And then whatever happened,
Wikipedia, I thought, oh, so they took that idea then and made a whole TV series out of it. That's what always happens. With your, what was it called, Richard and Judy?
This Morning Richard, not Judy, yeah, which it was, that was just very much used.
Slightly different.
Yeah, it was just using the format of a morning show to do comedy, really. It wasn't really about Richard and Judy themselves.
I had some great teeth made to play this presenter guy. A very sort of big, prominent front teeth, so that he could smile with a big tooth smile. And I had a sort of blow dried under wig,
right?
And he'd wear kind of white suits and casual.
Sounds good. Well, you know, again, but that would have been it's sort of like where Alan Partridge is, not quite Alan Partridge, but where his latest show is sort of headed into that.
Pre Alan Partridge, and I also, I remember because at the time I was very. I was in the news a lot, and I got recognised a lot in the street, and sometimes it was a hassle.
Sure.
And I could put on, he was called Jonathan Hughes, this character. I just put on Jonathan Hughes' teeth and wig, and used to wander around in true kind of, whoever is it, Brad Pitt style, you know. I'd wander around looking like Richard Madeley. And it was it was a good adventure. It was a good fun to
do. That sounds incredible. I wish I'd been involved in it, and I wish it had gone to series, because it sounds amazing. The other time that our lives crossed, I spent quite a lot of time in one of your houses. I was dating someone who was trying to be a writer, and she started doing a writing partnership with your wife at the time. She was my girlfriend at the time and your wife at the time, but I think you were selling the house because maybe she wasn't going to be your wife for very much longer. I would go around there, and they were writing a sitcom together, and I'd go around, and sometimes I was sort of script editing it, so I sort of went and helped a little bit. And then my girlfriend at the time was saying, you're looking for a house. This house is on the market. You should buy this house.
Was it a big house?
It was a pretty big house. It was sort of I remember it being a square around a little courtyard, sort of in Kingston or somewhere like that.
Yeah. No, I know exactly the time you're talking about.
So, but
that's all accurate. And you say she was a would-be writer, but she went on to become an incredibly successful writer.
She did, yeah.
Didn't she did. Kelly?
Yeah.
And she wrote Something Mr. Banks.
Yeah, Saving Mr. Banks. She's written some amazing
Saving
stuff.
Mr. Banks, yeah. She wrote. And at the time, she showed, because I was a friend of hers before she met my ex-wife.
Right.
And she used to come round when I was living on the boat and show me all these things she'd written. And they were all doable ideas, you know what I mean, that she'd hadn't developed.
Yes.
They were all things that you could actually say, you could develop that, you know. And didn't she go to America and get...
She went to America, she wrote a big sci-fi thing, I can't remember what it's called, but it was like a huge hit.
Yeah.
I lent her some money and...
She came back and said, I don't want to work there, I want to come back to England.
Yeah, she's. Yeah. I think she wrote the film of 50 Shades of Grey, though she wasn't very happy with the way that turned out. But,
oh, that's right, yeah. I knew she
So,
had,
you know, she's gone on to be much more successful. Yeah. But I read in the paper that, I don't know if it's the same house, but the house that I thought about buying... The tide came in and covered the garden, and I read an interview with you about your property.
Is it a
different house? Oh, that's right. I thought she'd tried to stitch me up because it wasn't.
No, that was at the time it was a very stressful time,
right.
Because I wasn't earning much money, and we bought this place that was on one of those little islands on the Thames,
right,
and we were trying to get planning permission, and it had to be put on stilts, and the tide came over the garden.
Right.
And it was a sort of financial disaster for us.
Right.
We just didn't have enough, you'd need a lot of time and money to make something like that work.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a romantic decision.
Sure.
And so I extended more rather than pulled back and bought the house that you're talking about.
Right.
And did it up.
It was very nice.
In order to make up the... Because it was it was in quite a bad state.
Right.
And we did it up in order to make up the losses on the... So at the time, I was having two properties and renting until they were livable in.
Right.
And I was working in fringe theatre at £350 a week.
Oh, my goodness.
But I thought, yeah... That was it. That was quite a tough time.
Yeah.
To sort of have the strain of that.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Well, but it came out good. It came out good in the end. Yeah. You know.
You sold it in the end. I'm glad I didn't bump into you then, stressed out and unhappy and.
Yeah. Me saying, "Who's this?
Who's this drinking?
Who's this in my house?
Drinking
Get
all
out
my
of my house." Yeah.
Good. Well, there's so much to talk to you about, so let me have a look and see where we're going to go. I'm always fascinated about the 80s comedy circuit, and you obviously were a huge part of that in the sort of early days of the Comedy Store with Peter Richardson in a double act. How did you two get together, and what were those early days like for you of sort of go? I presume you're working as actors, but then tried out comedy as well.
Well, no, not quite. In fact, I've been speaking to Peter a lot recently. We stayed in touch, but we've been having long conversations trying to remember those times recently. And the strange thing is that he remembers a completely different sequence of events from me. I had our first meeting down at one place. He had it somewhere else. Whole years have disappeared. And he remembers things that I've completely forgotten. So everything I say about it should be, you know, it's all subjective.
Of course.
I didn't realise how memory is like, it's like a muscle, isn't it? It's not a, it's not actually a bank where the memories are kept. It's just an instinct and a feeling, isn't
yes.
it? But as I remember it, we met at the at Glastonbury Festival.
Okay.
He lived, he was barefoot at the time and living in a van. And I was just an ordinary, he was up on the hill at Glastonbury and I was down among the mould, the fungi of all the tents.
Yeah.
And it was the early, I think it was the first time they'd had the pyramid. And we had a mutual friend who was an antique dealer who also had a van up on the top of the thing. And we met. And it was, he had been an actor. He'd been at drama school. I'd been a dropout. I was originally an actor in my teens and stuff.
Sure.
And then I'd been a dropout of university. And then I'd been travelling. And then I was sort of nowhere, and decided I wanted to go to drama school like I'd originally wanted to do but hadn't done.
Sure.
And I was just really pleased to meet on that kind of scene that I was on someone who knew, you know, who knew who Captain Beefheart and Frank Zappa were,
yes.
but also knew who Chekhov and Ibsen were
okay.
because, you know, it's uncool. It was not the coolest thing to say, I want to be an actor chap, when everyone really just wants to play lead guitar solos and be stoned. That was the scene.
Yeah.
And so it was nice to meet him, and we kind of said, we'll meet up again next year. And I went and worked. His parents ran a sort of summer school farm for kids whose parents had abandoned them over the summer.
Okay.
Like sort of Ambassador's Children and God knows what,
yeah.
in Dartmoor, in the middle of Dartmoor. And he said, do you want to come and teach on that? And I said, yeah, all right, teach what? And he said, oh, it doesn't, you know, that doesn't matter. We'll make some films and do some improvisations. The kids love that. And so that's what we did. And I lost 8 kids in the middle of Dartmoor and had to be rescued. Because I wasn't very good at the orienteering part or the sports part or anything.
Yeah.
But that's how we connected, and we started improvising and doing funny stuff
right.
then. And then when he helped me actually with my, I had an audition for a drama school for Lambda, and I showed him my auditions because he was the only other kind of actor person I knew. I didn't know it was possible. And so I got a place in the drama school, and it turned out that he'd parked his new van, which was a big van with a drum kit in it, where he was now living, a big Bedford lorry, outside this antique dealer guy's house, which happened to be just round the corner from my drama school.
Right.
So of an evening after college, I'd go into his van and we'd start. That's where Neil comes from,
right.
and that's where all the characters we did, and that's where our act came from.
Right.
We devised a show called Rank.
Yeah.
And with Pete Richens, who turned into Peter's partner, Pete Richardson and Pete Richens.
Yeah.
It's confusing. But at that part time, we met Pete Richens, who also came to sort of write and direct our show, Rank, which was about the Windsor Pop Festival.
Right.
Which the police, you won't remember, it's probably before you were born, because it's 19... When were you born?
I was born in 1967, so I think it was after I was born, but...
Yeah, but you're about 4.
Yeah,
I think, or, yeah, something like that. And the police took the opportunity to sort of create a riot
okay.
and clear the thing out of Windsor Park, and that was the theme of our story.
Right.
And my character from Fistful of Traveller's Checks, Paul,
yes.
the Mandrax freak from that, is the sort of main linking character in that show,
okay.
Rank. And he was looking for his daughter, Julie, but then he kept falling asleep and smashing people's guitars and stumbling through the festival.
Yes.
On the main stage were all the acts, and Peter was one of the presenters. He was also playing the chief of police, plotting to destroy us all.
Okay.
And he introduced Neil. That was the Neil was the one of the acts in that show.
Right.
And he reminded me the other day, he said, oh, you remember that time after we'd been rehearsing, we took over a whole house to rehearse and improvise in Ashburton, in Devon. Mm. And to make it soundproof, we moved all these straw bales up into the, into the room so that we could have the band in, because it was a rock show, you know.
Yeah.
And so we got thrown out for the fire risk. So we had to go and rehearse in this little barn up in the middle of Dartmoor. But, he said, you remember, it was here, we were in Ashburton,
right,
which is where this place was. This was recently. He said, sure, don't you remember, the one thing you wanted to cut when we were rehearsing it was Neil.
Wow.
Because you thought that it was sort of just pathetic. It was a stupid act. And he thinks it's because the band stopped laughing. When I first did it, the joke is quite obvious,
yeah,
you know. The joke of Neil saying, I'm going to do a couple of songs for you and they're both pretty bad, so I'm going to do the worst one first so the second one won't seem quite so bad. That sort of routine.
Yeah.
And when you first do it in rehearsal, you know, the band all pissed themselves. And then after sort of three or four rehearsals, they stopped laughing.
Yeah.
So I lost confidence. And Peter said, OK, well, just give it one. Just give it that first gig and try it. And, of course, that was the best thing. The audience loved this character, Neil. And so Neil was in. But
wow.
I was really... I was throwing
it's sort
proper,
of amazing. Yeah. It's amazing.
Fits, you know.
Sorry. I've got a slight delay on the thing, so sorry for talking over you there. I just thought it was amazing how many characters might have disappeared, you know, from the comedy lexicon in the same way the things that you pull out of and that one pulls out and goes, oh, I don't want to do that, and it could have gone on to be something amazing. It's sort of crazy to think of how much is lost and by that, because it is very difficult, that period where you're going, is this even funny, before you've put it in front of an audience. It's very easy, very easy to pull out.
Well, and also you could put it in front of the wrong audience.
Yes.
We had a character that made us, me and Rick and Aid, when we were preparing a Young Ones tour, we all sort of put in, it wasn't just Young Ones, we'd put in lots of other characters to do the first half of the show. And I invented this character, Mortimer Vaughan, who was very Steve Coogan-type character, who was an entertainer who'd had enough, and his wife had left, and he was smoking a fag, and he had a comb over, and I had a big pink frilly shirt, you know, down the front, like a Steve Coogan, can't remember that character he did.
Yeah, yeah.
But this guy, Mortimer Vaughan, really, he was a singer, and he just couldn't manage the gig, and he's just sort of going through the motions and saying, I'll sing a song and all that. Somebody call up, when are we leaving, and all that. And then he had a heart attack. And he said, seriously, honestly. And he's on the ground saying, no, seriously, could you call an ambulance? Like that. And we just thought it was so funny in the rehearsals. And we tried it out first night in a very big venue.
Yeah.
In Manchester, I think it was, or Sheffield. And they just thought, this is shit. The audience just thought, what's the hell's funny about this? He's just some old arse, you know, having a heart attack. What's so funny about that? It was like, and then he had to be dragged off, I think, like a la Tommy Cooper.
Yes.
Under the curtain. But it's one of those things where, I mean, we had 3 weeks of rehearsal where we thought we had an absolute winner with that one, because we were pissing ourselves. And that he only got one outing. But if he'd ever been, maybe, if it had been a little pub theatre and it could have been intimate and they could have seen what he was going through, and he started, you know, saying it was all his wife's fault when he was dying, and you know, he was down with his heart attack. I thought he was funny,
yeah.
But it was just the wrong audience to try him out on.
Yes, yes. Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of luck and chance, and you know, you've got to come up with the ideas, and yeah. Clearly you guys were shooting out ideas at that point. You know, it's incredible to think you were making up within that show you're discussing, that you were sort of, you know, creating things that would come to fruition in all those comic strip shows and obviously everything else that followed. It's wonderful when you have that level of creativity, I think, isn't it? And it often happens when you're young and you know, just starting out, that you just ideas are spilling out of you, which they clearly were then. So you took these. That was obviously like a touring show that then. What sort of drew you to going to do that in sort of chunks at the Comedy Store and the comic strip?
You mean the Rank?
Well, yeah, you and Peter
That show, yeah. That Peter show. Yeah, we did that at the Roundhouse,
right?
Originally, just a couple of weeks, the Roundhouse downstairs. One summer when everybody was up in Edinburgh.
Okay.
So we got all the audience and the journalists who hadn't gone to Edinburgh, and so we got an awful lot of coverage,
right,
for this, the one show that didn't go to Edinburgh, sort of thing. And we got an Arts Council grant for some rather sort of I don't think we did half the gigs were on the list of gigs we were meant to be doing, and we bought the PA. This was all against my better judgment. I mean, Peter was very sort of, what's the word? Just went ahead and did things,
right,
without really consulting anybody.
Okay.
I don't know what the word is for that. He just said, oh, you know, we're going to do that. That's what we're going to do. And he didn't really, he's quite, I mean, you must know, or I don't know, maybe you had an absolutely charmed double act.
I wouldn't say.
With Stuart. But it's every, but there isn't a double act that doesn't have, you know, some kind of feistiness,
of course,
going,
yeah,
on. And you know, I'm sure I was a pain in the arse as well, but it was quite difficult.
Yeah.
Dealing with what's he done next, you know what,
yes,
I mean? Anyway, we spent the money on a PA, and as it turns out, he was right, because that's the PA we then went on to use at the comic strip, and we, you know, we couldn't afford to buy a sound system when we went to the comic strip.
Yeah.
But we had this massive rock and roll sound system, okay, that we'd spent our Arts Council grant on. And I still had nightmares of the sort of the big door closing behind you when you went back into the Arts Council and the door would close and they say, where's our $2,000 or whatever it was, you know? Where's the money gone? You know, but... and we took it on tour with a rock band, and we supported... It was meant to be a theatre band show, you know.
Yeah.
But the only gigs we could get supporting, we supported Motorhead. We supported AC/DC.
Blimey.
We supported, who else did we go on for? I can't remember. It was like a university's tour.
Yeah.
And we were playing about 30 characters with full costumes and everything.
Right.
Quick changes and God knows what. And we put some of our own songs in. It was a mess, actually. By then, the show was a mess. So we left it, and it was a bit of a... It didn't really work,
right,
that second incarnation of this show. And then I had to get... I didn't have an equity card, and at the time, that meant you couldn't work,
yeah,
properly. So I went off and got some jobs. We didn't see each other for a year or two, and then I saw the ad for the Comedy Store, saying we're going to start up the Comedy Store, and I tempted or bullied Peter to come down with me, and we used, instead of having costumes and characters and a rock band and all those other expensive things, we just said, let's just, you and me, we'll just go up with a microphone, we'll just do what people think, I mean, that's what you would do these days,
yeah,
isn't,
yeah,
it? But in those days, to say, well, we can do the whole thing, just us. You know,
yeah,
we'll just do it. And if you want to shoot me, I'll go in the neck. I'll go like this. So we'll just use some crap mime.
Yeah.
And we'll do the whole thing with crap mime, just ourselves. And we did Space Invaders. piss take of space. You know, those little games, one of the early games, and we did AC/DC 10, which was a hijacking story of a man who shoots somebody. It was sort of movie spoofs. And we did Starsky and Bitch, yeah. Two guys driving down through San Francisco, bumping on, you know, a car chase, the way they're all going up and down.
Yeah, yes.
Because San Francisco's got the streets like that. And they were obviously very in love,
right.
Starsky and Bitch. And we did Are You Being Severed? which we ended up doing on some TV show that was called something like Friday Night and Saturday Morning, or that sort of... It was a late night chat show where they had floating hosts. So one week it would be... Nowadays it would be, I don't know, a comedian, and then it would be Jeremy Paxman would be the host that week or whatever. And it was a woman whose name, I'm sorry, I've forgotten, but she was a round-the-world yachtswoman.
Okay.
And she was very sort of attractive and blonde and well presented, you know. And she said, and now Nigel Planer and Peter Richardson are going to perform Are You Being Severed? And it's two villains done in the sitcom style. So one of them's going, ding dong, ding dong, and he drags in a bodyguard. Oh, sorry, Nigel. Yeah. Look, I don't know, what should we do with him? And the blood goes everywhere. He says, oh, I didn't know he's going to be a spurter. Maureen will kill me. So they saw up the body, and they're like sawing off the knob. And every time there's a sort of really, really gross bit, the camera cut back to this poor round-the-world yachtswoman with a sort of fixed grin going, ha, 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 ha. And... I had lines like, you know, oh, yeah, would you pour me a stiff drink? And I don't mean I'm going to dabble my knob in it. Sort of jokes like that. It was sort of sitcom in the style of... It was just Sopranos in the style of a sitcom, you know. And this poor... I can't remember her name, but we put her through... It must have been hell for her. Sitting through that. But yeah, so we had a sort of high-energy crap mime double act.
Yes.
Called The Outer Limits.
Yes.
And it, as it developed, we started doing solo bits in it. So there was Neil's act, and then Peter did Ken the Photographer, the disgusting fallopian tube photographer.
Right.
And I'd play... sort of page, he was a page, I played a song, I wrote a song called Page Three Girls to play while he did all this, he was playing a horrible, horrible photographer man. And there's quite a lot of, there were different things, and gradually, once it was at the comic strip, it became such a set show, it was no longer, and the generation of material sort of gradually stopped, and it became that show.
Right.
Four times a week or whatever it was.
And did it, as you were doing this and as the comic strip was taking off and the Comedy Store was taking off, did you feel like you were at the centre of something that was going to be as big as it was? Because obviously not everyone became huge TV stars, but many, many of them did, and many still had fantastic stand-up careers, even if they didn't make the TV. Did it feel like something revolutionary was happening and you were...
It did. I mean, Linda Sale, Alexi's wife, always says, oh, you know that thing where there's always a party that you'd think, oh, I wonder if it's better at that party. There's always a, and when you're at a party, you think, I wonder if there's any better than, you know, grass is always greener.
Sure.
And she said, the brilliant thing about that period is we were at the party.
Yeah.
You know, we were at the right party. So it did have that feeling, but I didn't know anything about the power of television. I just thought, I'm at the party I always wanted to be at. This is, you know, this is the stuff I want. This is it. I'm there where I wanted to be. But I didn't realise that when something goes out on, you know, the implications of that and the publicity, which is what everyone asks about. Like, oh, did you know how powerful it was going to be or how important or all of that? And I was completely unaware of that.
It was, I mean...
Because it's a surprise, isn't
yeah.
it? If some, you know, if what you like turns out to be what everyone else likes, then that was surprising. Not used to that.
Yeah, well, you know, with the young ones, I just remember, I mean, so few TV shows came along that were aimed at what felt like, you know, I was a teenager at the time, but, you know, there'd been Not That I Got News, but that had probably been 4 or 5 years before, you know, it had been several years before, and you're waiting and waiting, and I knew this thing was coming. And I knew about I was a big fan of Kevin Turvey's by this stage, you know. So I knew that Rick Mayall was in it, and I knew a bit about the rest of you from what I'd seen by, you know, finding those shows. But there was a real excitement about it before it even began. So, you know, it felt like everything came together, the stars aligned for that show, in that it was. And so many people of my generation, so many comedians of my generation, that was sort of the moment for them where that kind of went bang. This is our thing. We like Monty Python, but this is our thing. And this is, you know, and this feels possible. You know, it just made everything seem possible. The thing that I wanted to ask you about the young ones, and I've never really quite got to the bottom of it, is that clearly the Mike character was written for Peter Richardson, it seemed to me, and he didn't end up playing it. And that was, with the greatest respect to Christopher Ryan, but that was for me the character that in The Young Ones, even as a 14-year-old, I was thinking there's something that doesn't quite work about it. Was it Peter's decision not to?
It was it's quite convoluted story. It's to try and sort of shrink it down a bit, Peter was like the saw himself as the custodian of the group. He created this group. He'd taken us from the Comedy Store to the comic strip.
Yeah.
And from his point of view, this was his group. It was a cult. He was the leader.
That's right.
That was what's going on in his mind. Of course, Paul Jackson, producer, had been down and seen us at the Comedy Store, not necessarily at the comic strip. And there were a lot of TV people coming, and there were a lot of TV shows. There was even one called Book 'em and Risk It, which is a horrible... Imagine signing up, saying, yes, I'll do that, Book 'em and Risk It. Yeah. That's terrible. Yeah. Anyway, there were lots of people trying to get a slice of this new stand-up explosion, this new comedy explosion, onto television. And we did a show called Boom Boom Out Go the Lights, which was Paul Jackson. And Peter and I had been to see him. I'd heard tell of him, and he gave us an interview. And when it came to do the show, he didn't want to book Adrian, and he didn't want to book Peter.
Right.
He wanted to split the double acts
right.
up in the way the BBC does. But it wasn't just that. To speak on his defence, he had only one chance at it because they weren't going to give him everything he wanted first up. He said, I'll do you two shows, and one of them was, I can't remember what, was a more digestible, normal BBC show.
Yeah.
And the other one, I want to try these new comics from Soho, from the Comedy Store. They weren't going to let it spread all over the place.
No.
So he felt he had to take the sort of the peak moments and cut them together. And it, fair enough, you know.
Yeah.
He then did a second one, and he did include Adrian, and he included Peter. But Peter was well miffed at the idea that that double act should be split up.
Right.
And evidently, I didn't know this, but later there was a thing where Paul had said he was interested in the whole comic strip, but he didn't want the girls.
Right.
Now, I don't remember that, but... And Peter was saying, no, you either take what I say you take, which is all of us, or you take... another, because he's... That's the sort of... It was a personality clash,
sure.
I think. You've got Paul, who's the ultimate sort of practical do what's possible now, get a foot in the door, then do the next bit, then do that, and somehow we'll find a way through. And Peter, who's got this attitude of, unless I can have 100% the integrity the way I see it,
yeah,
I'm not doing it.
Sure.
And those two, I get caught between the two, and I'm very lucky because I get to do both.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I get the goodies from both of those because I'm sort of sympathetic to both sides of that argument. But and anyway, so there was a falling out between Paul and Peter. That's really. I mean, I'm just going back over what I've said now. Is anybody going to be offended by what I just said? Well, it's tough. I mean, that's how I
know, but
I saw
it's sort
it,
of
anyway.
It, you know, I sort of assumed. Yeah, I sort of assumed it was something along those. Paul was very influential in getting our second lot of TV shows going. So I've got a lot of respect for Paul, but I also do love what Peter's done. So I kind of felt that might be it. Did it put a strain between you two though that you ended up doing it and he didn't?
Yeah.
So it was.
Yeah, it did, which is why it's so good. Recently, yeah, we've been having these long conversations, kind of memoir type conversations, yeah, and we've been through all this material and. You know, we've stayed very close, you know, very warm,
yeah,
and close, but it did at the time put a wedge between us.
Sure.
And I always felt I was, I suppose that's another matter. Yeah. But it did. I mean, and Peter was well miffed.
Of course.
But he now also sees that if he had played that part, he wouldn't have been happy, he wouldn't have been good at it, it wouldn't have suited him. He likes making films.
Yeah.
He likes doing two or three takes, getting it right. He likes the artifice and the you know, the control that you have, the artistry,
yes,
in a film. And the idea of just cutting something together to get the joke done.
Yes.
Peter would have freaked out. And then putting a live audience while you're trying to cut it, which is what, of course, a live sitcom is.
Yeah.
You've got an audience. And the camera, the visions are mixers, trying to get all the different cameras. And Peter would have just had a meltdown doing it.
Yeah,
like
that's
that.
Interesting. And that's interesting because I can, you know, I can completely see him doing it. And I think hitting the right, it did work. But as it was, of course. But I think that's interesting that possibly, I hadn't considered that possibly the wrong personality type in there could have blown the whole thing apart as well. You know, and a very strong personality in that part could have actually destroyed the
yeah,
show.
I mean, that's, we a lot of other people were considered. And I think, actually, we got lucky with Chris Ryan. Mm. I think poor guy, he gets people like this podcast going, oh yeah, well, he was the wrong guy, wasn't he, for this major job that he's done. He's an incredibly funny man. He was the one making us all laugh.
Sure.
He's very, very funny. And if you think what a thing to be thrown, oh, here's this part, we've all been working together,
yeah,
for sort of 5 years now, and we know each other's ways, and we've all written each other's parts and know each other's jokes, and we're all kind of really thick with each other. Do you fancy coming and being the other one who hasn't really been quite written properly yet? Do you want to, you know, do you fancy that? And I personally think if he hadn't done it the way he did it,
yeah,
I think we would have lost a lot. I think if we'd had another wild and crazy guy,
sure,
I don't think it would have been as good. I think he's actually the anchor for the whole thing.
Yeah,
It's rather like if you watch Morecambe and Wise, you laugh at Morecambe. But if you look at the same routine again and just block Morecambe out and look at what Ernie Wise is doing,
yeah,
he's a genius of suggestion.
Yeah.
It's what it's what's in his eyes and where he looks, and then he looks over there, and then it's just he's just willing it forward.
Yeah,
and I see Chris like that. He's just kind of making sure that we can all be as funny as we are. I do think he's sort of saved the day, really.
Sure, I completely see what you're saying, and I you know, it does. That's very interesting. I think just like as a fan of, you know, the comic strip and all that you guys have done together, I guess there's just as a fan of it, And, you know, as a comedian now, I know how annoying this stuff is as well. And I know how annoying fans are when they go, well, I didn't like that one as much as this one. So I understand both perspectives of it. But yeah, I think maybe what jarred was that the other three of you, you know, that he probably was just trying to find his place in it as much as anything. But you're right. I think it did work for the character. And why would a cool guy hang around with those? It's the sort of Fonz question, is it? Why is the Fonz hanging around with all those idiots in Milwaukee? Why was Mike, if someone had done that and made it even cooler in any sort of way,
in a real cool way,
it would have been wrong as well. So yeah.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Man, it's such a good series. The thing I wanted to talk to you about, and I don't want to talk about the other ones too much because there's so much else to talk about. Paul Putner, who was in a lot of my stuff, wrote a very nice piece about going to see the Bambi episode, and then Nick Revel, which was lovely. And Nick Revel, he was in the audience of it. Nick Revel, the comedian, then tweeted and said that after that performance, you and he had gone for a curry and been attacked by some guys. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I certainly do. It wasn't... well, this is memory again, you see. It was a Greek, not a curry.
Okay. That's very important.
It's very important, yeah. Because it was right by the BBC studio. Was it Shepherd's Bush?
Yeah.
And it was... my stepson was with us too.
Right.
It wasn't just me and Nick. And some guys came up and... drunk, and they later said at the court case that they thought we were other somebody else,
right,
or something. But then that made it okay to come and punch me in the face,
right,
and headbutt me, and generally beat us up. And Nick ran over the road and phoned the police, which was a sensible thing to do, because in those days you didn't have mobiles; you had to go to the phone box. And I managed to, my stepson, I said, look, run the other way. But it could have got nastier. There were three guys. One of them was very big. And they had uniforms on.
Okay.
Of a very well-known security company.
Okay.
Which, when we reported to the police, that little fact got obliterated from the report.
Okay.
Strangely.
Nice.
I don't know why or what was going on there.
Mm.
But they were uniformed employees of a very famous security company.
Right.
Fucking, excuse me.
Yeah.
Anyway, we were rescued by Dave Barton, who was the special effects guy.
Right.
He's now sadly died, but he was a Scotsman, a very, very you know, one of those people who's very highly energized and everything's got to be sort of in second gear, driven at 40 miles an hour in second gear. You know, yeah. He's always on. And he was a great bloke, and he was from Glasgow, and he saw over the road, he was coming to the Greek too, and he vaulted over the middle thing in the road, jumped over, and came and headbutted the guy and floored him.
Right.
By which time the police arrived and arrested Dave Barton. So it was a good evening, yeah. And then Paul Jackson arrived, making sure everything was emollient as usual. You know, he was in charge. Yeah. He did well. And we were in the back of a police van.
Wow.
Because we were then all taken back to the station. And in the police van, they were all going, "Oh, heavy," to me, and quoting from The Young Ones. That's how I remember it. Now, Bambi, that means Bambi must have been in the second series, was it?
Yes, it was.
That would completely ruin my story if Bambi was in the first series, because it hadn't been out.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
But if it's in the second series, yeah, Bambi's in the second
series. I'm sure series. It was. I mean, it's sort of the classic episode. It's you know, yeah. Out of all of them, there's so much great stuff in that one. And again, the thing that Paul revealed in his write-up was, I think, was the eclair falling onto you all.
Oh, yeah.
Happened live, and you get quite badly hurt from that as well. As
yeah, I mean, they all have a go at me for being such a hypochondriac. But the point is, I'm taller than all of them, so I took the full weight of the eclair, if you see what I mean. And it's a good, you know, 20-foot long, 3-foot high bit of sponge, which landed on my neck. Yeah.
So you had that, and you thought, well, that's my bad luck for the day out. And then you walked out and were headbutted by a man in the street.
Yes.
And then had your catchphrase thrown at you.
Yes.
one more thing. The time's rushing by, but the other thing about Neil was obviously the pop career, which meant that you ended up being at the recording of Do They Know It's Christmas?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I got a call from Sir Bob, who wasn't Sir Bob at the time, was he? No.
No.
Saying, come along, we're going to do this thing. And I didn't want... It seemed to me, I was quite purist about these things, and it seemed I was quite well informed on third world matters because of that was what I'd studied at university, even though I dropped out. And it seemed to me that coming along in a comedy character, I always found that in Comic Relief in later days as well, that, you know, that was fun, wasn't it? And now let's look at some... Now let's look at some poor children with flies on their eyes.
Yeah.
You know, I always found it slightly jarring.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I got there and in dressed as Neil. And I sort of chickened out and thought, I'm not going to actually go in and stand in the row and sing Feed the World, Let Them Know It's Christmas, even though they're Muslims, you know, or whatever. It did seem a bit... It also seems a bit... I don't know. Nowadays, I think it would be investigated, wouldn't it? The tone, the colonialist tone of the event would nowadays come under some scrutiny, I think. But then the intention was very good anyway. And so I just hung around in the studio and filmed the sort of the making of stuff. Right. There was a camera guy going around the side. So I didn't do the singing bit. And we did a... routine. Me and Status Quo did a routine in the gents for the cameras. I don't mean a routine in the gents the way it sounds, but we did some. I can't remember what we did, but yeah. So I messed about and sort of led the making of crew through, which seemed to me more acceptable than being a comedy character.
Yes,
trying to do something serious just didn't quite seemed to be
seemed
a bit condescending, you know.
I think it's a trade-off, isn't it? I can see both sides of it, but I sort of do veer to what you're saying, and I think you're right about that. Though it would have been great to have Neil saying, "Thank God it's them instead of you," doing that line with Neil. It would have kind of ruined the song. It would have been great. I mean, it wasn't great the way whoever did it. Anyway, look, I've got so much more I want to talk to you about. What I've really loved recently on Twitter and YouTube is that the Nicholas Craig stuff has sort of resurfaced. And I'd almost forgot. I think out of all the post Young Ones shows by any of the Young Ones, I think that's the best one and the most successful one, I think. I think it's a very difficult act to follow, but because it's so different and it's so well observed, and the book was great. I remember getting the book, and the book was great. And then did the series come after the book? Did the series come out of the book, or was it?
The book was first. Yeah. The book was first. Yeah.
So yeah,
then the one man show, and then the series, and then radio, and then the TV series.
Because they're all on YouTube now, and people are tweeting them quite a lot.
Most of them are. Yeah. I'm not sure if they're all on, but most of them are. Yeah.
And what was the genesis of that? Was that one looking into yourself a little bit and taking the piss out of yourself?
Yeah, well, it was because after the comic strip and the Young Ones, that were no longer sort of the pressing, you know, there was no longer you've got to do this and you've got to do that. The demand was slightly fading, and I thought, all my mates have got their own TV shows, and they're all doing the same as what we did before. French and Saunders and Rick and Aid are doing this stuff now. Everybody's sort of moving onward in the same direction, and it seems to have not been that. And I want to, what was it that was good? What have I done that? What was good about what I did? And I thought it was because Neil came from my own failings or whatever, you know, my own past, living in a squat, traveling to Asia overland with no money, and generally and the drugs, and so Neil came out of all the people I'd met during a period of my life, and the sort of a satirical comment on, say, Windsor Festival, which I thought was a joke, you know, I thought it was a terrible thing. And so I thought, well, what is it that I've ever done that you know, why don't I go back to how I laid a good egg rather than try and exploit the egg I've already laid? Because I tried to exploit Neil, and it ended up being a bit of a, you know, I did a record, I did a book, I did a tour, and it ended up being a bit over exploited and became slightly a parody of itself. Sure. And I thought, I'll try and make it like Barry Humphries and make him go into sort of hippie superstar or something. And none of that really worked.
No.
And so I thought, I'll go back to the genesis of this. And what have I been these last few years? I went to drama school. I get very, 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 very sort of uptight about people not taking acting seriously. And that's, they all used to tease me in the Young Ones and say, oh, you know, you're the, you know, I used to throw actor hissy fits and be very actorish. And, you know, one day we were filming with Lemmy from Motorhead in the middle of Devon somewhere, and the call was at 5:15 in the morning. And at 5:15 in the morning, they'd all been drinking the night before, but I was a proper actor. And so I got an early night in and learned my lines, like you do. And at 5:15 in the morning, I was the only person there waiting to go. Even the driver, you know, was hungover and fast asleep. And then down the stairs came Lemmy, who obviously had drunk more than anybody. He was the only other professional actor in the whole film. And so I thought, I'll go back to doing, you know, the genesis of it. What made this work? And I'll create another character. And so I thought up this character, Nicholas Craig, and then I wrote some stuff for him, but it wasn't quite spunky enough. And I met Christopher Douglas, who writes Ed Reardon, right, and Bard on the radio. Yeah. And he's very much knew what I was talking about, because both of his parents and step-parents, all actors and in the business, he'd been a child actor.
Right.
He was the cheeky waiter in Crossroads. you know, he knew the scene,
yeah,
and has a very, very sharp, vicious, you might say, wit. You know, he's really cruel.
Yeah.
The more cruel stuff comes, you know, he's very, very acute. And so we teamed up and wrote the book, and it gradually became more of a performance thing for me. Originally, I wasn't sure I was even going to be the performer,
right,
of it. We were just wanting, and then as I became the performer of it, he became the writer and director of it, and we shared the creativity. But so, and we ended up doing those TV things.
Yeah.
Again, God knows how they allowed us to do that. We had to do them rather like the Young Ones. We had to do them through a different department.
Right.
Young Ones had to be done through Variety. That's why we had the bands, because of the budget.
Yes.
We couldn't get into the comedy department. And with Nicholas Cray, we had to do it through News and Features. Because it was real. From The Late Show, Alan Yentob's Late Show, where they did cultural...
Yeah.
Comment, and he first appeared doing a sort of cultural comment, I think, about the Wogan show,
right?
And we wrote that first sort of piss take of how to behave on a Wogan show,
right?
If you get asked, you know, you have to say, "For me, I think that," so for me, and you show all the extracts of all the actors who've said "for me,"
yes,
on Wogan, and and from that, with the same producer, Caroline Wright, we sort of developed it into these TV series.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, it probably stands up better than, you know, it's very hard for comedy to work 20 or 30 years later, I think, anyway, you know, and The Young Ones is still worth watching, but it's, you know, it doesn't have the same excitement. But I think The Nicholas Craig stuff, it just feels just as fresh as that could easily have been made.
Oh, that's brilliant.
You know, it's lovely, but it's lovely. Thank stuff. It's,
yeah,
it's, I don't know, maybe it's a bit in for people in the business, possibly, but I don't think it is, because you broaden out.
I think people are more literate now,
yeah,
aren't they?
They're
more screen literate,
yeah,
with it and everything.
And I think just
we made a decision not, you know, to be as in as we could, because we thought if we do like a Harry Enfield spoof of an actor, he'll have to say darling a lot, and let's just do it exactly how we feel, the people we actually know. Let's do it for real. And you know, it might not sell as many tickets,
yeah,
sort of thing, but at least we've done this thing that's kind of authentic.
Yeah, no, it really is authentic. It's, you know, it's the lovely way, always, you know, this false modesty of not wanting to take over the
oh, yes.
And they go, no, I can't. No, go
right.
On, Nick. Go on. And they've all been told to say it. No, it's absolutely lovely. And, you know, I think I was saying this to you before we came on air, but I think what I always admire and what I always sort of hope for in my own career as well is to sort of just the longevity of keeping on working and doing a variety of things and... you know, and always being there. And I think when you look through your whole career, I mean, you're still working now, you're still writing now, and you sort of seem to be churning out plays now, which is fantastic, because a lot of people would sort of rest on their laurels. But also, you've worked in the show, films like Yellowbeard, where you're working with some of the Pythons, but you've also worked with the next generation. Along a lot, you've been in a lot of sitcoms. I mean, you're in Brazil as well, of course, which is absolutely fantastic. Carry On Columbus as well, but you know, can't have everything.
Which is not so absolutely fantastic, really.
But still, yeah, exciting to be in the Carry On. You're in that genre, but you've managed to, you know, to find a place throughout all of this career and still be kind of hitting. The marks and coming up with stuff and appearing alongside, you know, the stars of today as well, which is, you know, isn't true of everyone.
Well, that's That's brilliant to say. I found a place that I don't feel that. No. But now you've said it, I probably will. That's but just fantastic.
It's incredible. You know, I think often with this, with doing this podcast, I'll have people on, and either they're newish and I haven't seen everything they've done, or they've been going for a long, long time, and you're not necessarily aware of everything. But when you look at someone's career and go, oh my goodness, you know, and I think some people do just coast, or they give up, or the career gives up on them. And I think with you, it's you know, you're always, I mean, you've moved into musicals. You were always doing. I know you'd understudied David Essex in Evita, so you were always, that was always there. But also like playing parts in other people's sitcoms. You're in Death in Paradise, which is my kind of guilty pleasure obsession that I...
It is a guilty pleasure, that, isn't it?
It's,
that was, I really enjoyed doing that one too.
Well, I keep on mentioning...
I did a Father Brown as well.
Oh, yes.
That's another guilty pleasure. It's nice to play... I like it when I get offered kind of seedy characters to do. And those are both really untrustworthy, seedy kind of old school types, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And you've been...
That was fun.
I mean, there's so much I want to try and get in. I'll try and get some of it in. But you've been working with Aid Edmondson again. So you did Vulcan 7.
Yeah, Vulcan. We wrote a play. Yeah. We took it on tour. And we've now done a rewrite. And it's now called... We've changed the title.
Right.
It's now called Is Heading Straight Towards Us.
Okay.
And it worked just the day before the lockdown last year. Yeah. We did a reading. We realised we're a bit too old to play those two main characters now.
Okay.
And also the two of us acting together made it a bit young onesy. The audience expectation was that there'd be a lot of shouting and farting and things. So we got some proper actors in to play the parts for this reading.
Okay.
To see if we could get it on in the West End, and we were talking about it, and then the lockdown happened, so I don't know. I hope that gets picked up again. It's Heading Straight Towards Us. We had Tony Gardner.
Oh, great.
And Samuel West.
Oh, I love both.
Samuel West was playing my part,
right,
and Tony Gardner was playing Adrian's part.
Oh, brilliant.
But, I mean, they're no longer our parts. They're what we wrote and performed. But, and it worked really well with two proper actors being you know, just being hideous to each other.
Sure.
Whereas with us two, there was a slight tendency to just start shouting at each other, because that's what we sort of fell back on. You know what I mean? But I think it's really funny. It's two guys and their runner caught in a caravan on the side of a volcano, who are stuck there while they're filming the seventh in the series of Vulcan films. They're actors and they knew each other, and there's a lot of history between them that's very unpleasant. and they get stuck there, and the set moved up and up as the avalanche, you know, as the volcano. And at the end, we were literally on a set like that, crawling up the set. It's very funny, and it's really quite touching at the end as well, in a proper sort of bromance way.
Yes. Great.
It's a lovely play, that. And then I've got a tour.
Good.
Am I allowed to plug something?
Yes, please do.
Hopefully that... Yeah, my plug for the day, because I'm just astonished that it's happening. After, you know, as you say, I've written a lot of things, and basically everything came to a halt.
Yes.
Over a year ago, just all stopped. But then out of the blue... something called the Northern Theatre of Comedy, Northern Comedy Theatre. This guy, I got put in touch with him and sent him a script that everyone rejected, like 3 years ago, something like that. It was a farce. It's just a comedy thing.
Yeah.
And everybody said, no, you can't do that for this reason or that reason or whatever. And I have worked on it since, so I have improved it.
Sure.
Anyway, he said, oh, I'll do that. It's called All Above Board.
Okay.
And he casts it with local actors in Liverpool. And he puts it on tour, and it's going to Coventry and all through July, August, September.
Oh, fantastic.
It's an actual... an actual gig. I can't believe it. You know, after a year of total despondency, the play that actually is first off the marks is the one you'd given up on.
Oh, that's
you know, I thought, oh, no, you know, nobody want that. Because they told me they didn't, you know. And but this guy's seen how it's funny. And the moment someone believes in it, I've gone back and written a draft that actually is pretty funny now, I reckon. I reckon it's now sort of in better shape. Because he said, no, that's funny. Don't change that bit. You know, because he gave me the courage.
Yeah.
You know, because you need to have somebody believing in it, don't you?
You do, and it's so good to hear that, you know, because, again, as a writer, and, you know, it's the people are... There are people who can get everything they write made, but most writers are writing and 90% of what they're doing will never, you know, really see the light of day.
Ooh, so it's, do you think it's as bad as that? Yeah, it is.
I think it probably is. Well, it is for me. so it gets,
just for me, yeah.
As I'm getting older, I'm thinking, oh, that'll never happen. But, you know, just to even hear that, you go, oh, well, maybe someday someone will...
Maybe there's hope. Yeah.
It just takes one person. It is really interesting. You know, it's interesting you're mentioning Paul Jackson, because Paul Jackson... A couple of times in my career has just stepped in and gone, oh, no, you've got to have Richard Herring or you've got to have Leon Herring. And we weren't going to be going anywhere. It just takes that one person to go, well, you know, what do you think? You know, with that, the whole return to us for the BBC was Paul Jackson saying, oh, you've got to have Leon Herring. What are you talking about? And then he did the same for me on ITV and got my thing on the last thing I did on ITV.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. You know, it's when you've got somebody in your corner who will... He'll stand up for you. It's such an amazing thing to get. But, you know, it is... It's
rare.
It's rare, but it's keeping on pushing on, and that's, you know, but and it's reinventing and not just, you know, I think that's what's interesting, because I think you could have just thought, I'm gonna push Neil until it's really, you know, in the ground, and I think, you know, you stepped away.
You really?
I think you could bring it back now and people. Well, no,
I'm not sure.
I think you could have done more with it, and I think you could bring it back, but I think it's much more interesting to carry on. I was interested to hear that he was Neil's, like, a massive hit in Catalonia, which I did not...
Incredible. On the street in Barcelona, I get recognised as Neil, but not from my voice, because, of course, I was dubbed by this guy... Who does it in a completely different way. So if I want people to laugh at Neil, I have to go, oh, tears. I have to talk in this completely different cartoony voice. Pazurus malaria muska moris. Like that. Mal karma. Mal karma. It's ridiculous. But I went out there and did a one-man show, and they, you know, which was... Semi in Catalan. I learnt some bits of Catalan, right. But then I'm not Eddie Izzard. I can't do shows in nine languages. But I did it sort of half in Catalan, and then Ivana, this friend, came and does a sort of interview translation, and we kind of linguify together. And it's great. It was good. We did. And another play I'd written is really big still in Barcelona now, called El Sostre. It's on the ceiling, which, again, didn't do that well in this country. Did quite well, and it went on radio.
Yeah.
It did okay, but not, you know, but in Barcelona, the people are thinking it's great. It's a two-hander, and people just love it. It's about the Sistine Chapel. So, but, again, the... My getting high on thinking, this is great, I can relive my youth walking around the streets of Barcelona. That's kind of died a bit now, what with the lockdown.
It has.
But it did go to my head a bit, I must admit.
And so do you like being read? Because it felt like, you know, from stuff I've read and heard you talking about, it felt like that level of success that you had with the young ones became, you know, not only being beaten up in the street, which wasn't directly to begin with to do with that, but being recognised and having people shouting catchphrases at you was something that maybe annoyed you. But do you sort of miss it, or are you glad that it's moved on from that?
There's a level at which it was really uncomfortable.
Sure.
And there's people who grab your elbow and won't let you, you're going somewhere, they'll grab your elbow and say, "Oi, come here, come here. He's this is it's him," you know, and you, that's really intimidating, yeah. And I don't like that. But it, I don't know. I've got so used to it. It you know, there's actually been more of my life with that than there has without that.
Sure.
Which is, you know, when you get old, you think, God, this is the most of my life's been like that. So I've got nothing to compare it with anymore now.
Sure.
it can get uncomfortable, but not. I mean, it's quite nice now. I remember thinking, hey, I'm in a supermarket. It's great. I can actually get round a supermarket. And I don't know how people, I mean, maybe some people really do enjoy that constant reminder.
Yeah.
Of their job, of their work, and it's, I don't really enjoy that constant reminder. I like it when people have seen something obscure, like I really like, if you'd come up on to me on the street and said, oh, that Nicholas Craig, you know, that really stands the test of time. Yeah. That's really good, that is, well done. You know, that's just, that would make my day. Sure. That's brilliant. And you did make my day today saying that. Just people going, like throwing snowballs at you because they think you're Neil from the Young Ones and it's okay to smash you on the head. You know, that's not, that's, there's not much good about that.
Yes, I guess so. Look, I won't take up too much more of your time. Also, my connection's getting really weird, so I'm going to.
Is it?
Yeah, I'm going. I'm just. It's the delay's getting almost. I think it's working for everyone else, but I'm finding it difficult to keep up. But look, I appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us, and I hope everyone will go and see your play, and I hope the science fiction one will reappear out of the ashes the volcano.
It's not really a science fiction one. But it's an actor chap. Yes. It's a caravan one. Sure. It's a bitching one.
but it's so lovely to talk to you. And honestly, you know, all the stuff you've done has been. I hope you appreciate how much the influence of everything you and obviously the whole of the comic strip did has had on a generation of comedians. I think, you know, and I think talking to you, realise again there's a lot of things that even in the stuff you've talked about that presage what was to come with lots of other things. So it's you know, I'd like to thank you for that personally, and thank you for all that sitting here in Cheddar where I had all the Young Ones on tapes which I'd written
VHS.
On the VHS tapes and they just played them and played them and played them. So it's absolutely fantastic to talk to you, and thank you for coming on the show.
Next week,
I'm back in the theatre for the people at home listening at home, and I'll be talking to Jeff Norcott. I've already recorded it, so it's confusing for me. But we're back in the theatre. This is the last remote one for a little while, but we might pick up the occasional one just for fun. But for now, ladies and gentlemen, give it up for the amazing Nigel Planer. Thank you very much.
Great.
See you next week, everyone.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Goodbye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Nigel Planer. Thank you to Scant Regard for this controversial but brand new theme tune, which will not get us into any kind of trouble as companies increasingly crack down on what they considered unlicensed music, even though we did have the rights to the previous one. This is just easier for us, so thank you to Scant Regard. I'm loving the new tunes. I'm indebted to my producer and friend, Chris Evans, not that one. I'm indebted to Ben Walker, of course, who's been putting the ads together for us. And we'll be returning to producer duties very soon. And I also would like to thank everyone at ACAST, British Comedy Guide, etc. And my mum and dad, this one genuinely, for allowing me to broadcast from their home. When I should have been spending some time with them. Sorry for that. I've messed up. When this one was going to be and forgot I was going to Cheddar. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Please go to GoFasterStripe.com/badges, become a monthly badger. You will get news about forthcoming guests before everyone else, plus badges, plus ad-free podcasts, plus a membership pack with a secret code, plus access to hundreds and hundreds of extra backstage videos and other stuff that is not available. Do check out richshane.com/gigs and come and see these last live shows at the Platinum Grand. Very exciting lineup. I know you will.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. Do come say hello after the show if enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.